Hello, everyone. Can you hear me? In the back? I can't hear you say yes or no. I am Karen, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon too. Especially now when I'm down on terra firma. God. That elevator, I had to stand and face the wall, you know, I couldn't even look out. And so if you have a little vertigo, get Dan to take you to lunch. Well, thank you so much for inviting us here. We love to come to Canada. We've been in Toronto before. And last time we were here, they took us just across the street and showed us the railroad station. I love that, you know. That's fine with me. Anyway, we're so glad to be here. And you're a wonderful group. I was in the meeting this morning when Johnny spoke. I sat in the back. Some of the stuff he tells you, you know, I just kind of would like to not be known around here, but that's okay. Well, I hope there are some new people in Al-Anon out there. And of course, in Al-Anon, we're new longer than you are in AA. Did you know that? Down in Laguna Beach, when they ask, we go to a Wednesday night open meeting, speaker meeting, AA meeting. And there they ask for new people with under 30 days of sobriety to stand and identify themselves. And after that, they don't ask them anymore. But in Al-Anon, it takes us longer. I don't know. Maybe we're not as sincere. I know for one thing, we usually don't have the law looking for us. I don't know. You know. What do I know? But if you're new and you have come in here in order to sober up somebody in your family or someone you know or love, that's one of the best motivations of all for coming to Al-Anon, I think. It won't work, but you're here and you'll find some answers for yourself. And by the way, I want to say this. I don't always say it, but I heard some talk this weekend, and you know, you're not an Al-Anon just because you're married to an alcoholic or an AA member or have a kid or, you know. An Al-Anon is someone who attends Al-Anon meetings and practices the 12 steps of Al-Anon, which are the same as AA's 12 steps. And I don't say that as a put-down or a criticism. I say it because I don't want you to deny yourself this marvelous program, because it's as powerful for the non-alcoholic as it is for the AA. Nobody can argue with the fact that you guys and girls quit drinking. I think that's still stunning to me, to see John the way he was carrying on and to see him stop drinking. It was amazing. And I'm always so impressed with that. So we don't have that, but there can be a turnaround in our lives too. And that's what I wanted to say. Okay, one of the first things they told me when I came to Al-Anon was that it wasn't my fault. Oh, I love that. I love that. Johnny regularly told me, no wonder he had the drink, you know, being married to me. But then the next thing they told me was that I was sick. Sicker maybe than the alcoholic. That did not sit well. I mean, really. But then again, you know, it's all right if you're sick when you come in here. It's all right if you're full of fear and hostility and anger and all those negative things. I'd really worry about you if you came in serene and happy. You know, that would be strange. I mean, you'd almost have to be on something. And that also happens. But anyway, so it says I'm from Laguna Beach, California, and that's not really where I'm from. I was born long, long ago, far, far away, in Lapland, Sweden, 50 miles north of the Arctic Circle. Can you imagine? And my father was building a railroad up there. And there was drinking and partying in our house on the weekends. Those railroad men, they either gathered at our house or somebody's house, and there was drinking and laughing and singing. And ever since I was real small, I had a great need to shape up the people around me. So if anyone laughed too loud or sang too loud, I'd tell them about it. That big. And I got sent to my room a lot. But my father was a lot of fun. I can remember some of that. He had a big Harley Davidson motorcycle with pontoons on for the snow, you know, and a sidecar. And I had one older sister, and he'd take us two girls in that motorcycle once in a while, and that was fun. But when he drank, I didn't like him. And when I was 10 years old, we moved to Stockholm, which is the capital of Sweden. And my father's drinking increased down there. And I really had trouble because I was in a school and I had some friends. And sometimes I wanted to bring them home with me, and I could never be sure that my father wouldn't show up drunk. And I can remember my mother saying to me, "Please, Daddy's coming home now. Don't say anything. Go to your room or go to a friend's house." And Daddy would come in, and he was a huge fella. And he was really just ready to go to bed. He was a peaceful drunk. He was very big and very strong and known for it. And I don't know, I think something had happened that he decided never to mix into anything. But I would go toe-to-toe with that man and tell him how I felt about his drinking. And I could never keep my mouth shut. And mother had to hustle me out of the house many times. I had to quit school when I was 15 because of his drinking. I had gained entrance to a better school. You had to take tests and get in. And I firmly believed this all the way into Al-Anon. And of course I found out that wasn't how it was. I had discovered movies. I was of an age where I could go to a little more fun movies. And I loved American movies most of all. I didn't understand the language, but I could read subtitles. And I had got some grandiose ideas in there, and I wanted to dress like Lois, you know who I'm talking about, Gloria De Haven and June Allison dress. And I came home one day from school, and I said, "I've got a job, and I've quit school, and I'm not going back." That was how that really was. Nobody wanted me to quit school, and least of all my father, I think. And, well, of course, I couldn't make any kind of money. So I went back to school, but I got a little night job. I lied about my age, and I sold chocolates in a movie theater. And that was really the first peace and quiet my family had had, because I was out of the picture. My mother and my sister never took Daddy to task for his drinking, you see. They just left him alone. The summer I was 17... as Johnny told you several times, I was working in an office in Stockholm, and one of their Southern Branch people came up, and he was pretty. Oh my, he was very dark, dark eyes, and beautifully dressed, beautiful manners. That was when manners were in, you know. You couldn't take a cigarette without him being there with his zipper lighter. Anyway, And all the women in the office, we whispered about this fellow and wondered about him. And we used to straighten our seams when he came around. But he liked me, and we became friends. And we'd go to lunch together and have breaks together. And the summer went by, and the end of September, he asked me for a date. It was his birthday. And he said, "What do you do on Saturday night?" And I said, "I go dancing at the Winter Palace." Doesn't that sound good? And it was. I was looking at this there. And it was like the Palladium in Hollywood. And they had a big band, and they played Glenn Miller and Artie Shaw and all that good stuff. And he said, "I'll come and dance with you." And so he did. And that was the beginning. And he spoke with a southern accent. We have a south in Sweden. Sweden is no bigger than California, but we have regions of dialects. And Johnny came from a town very close to Denmark. And so I had a little trouble understanding what he said sometimes. In fact, a couple of times I said yes when I should have said no. So, moving right along, in 6 months we were engaged, and a year after that we were married. And see, the most marvelous part about this man was that he didn't drink. And I had promised myself, and I had said it to my dad, "You bet, when I find someone, it'll be someone who didn't drink." After we'd been married 6 months, Johnny came to me and said, "How would you like to go to America?" And everything was going my way, you know. Hadn't I found this beautiful man? And now I was going to learn to speak English. And when Johnny said we were going to Los Angeles, I knew it. We were going to be in Van Johnson's backyard, you see. So, as John said, in 1948 we came to California. And he says, I got to take this up with you, John. It really bugs me. He says, "We came from Sweden and she was pregnant. You know, we came to Los Angeles on the 7th of July, and I probably got pregnant on the 30th of June." I mean, we didn't find out for a couple of months. You know, remember that piano bench? Anyway. Can play this game, you know. I mean, he makes it sound like a couple of rubes, you know, being pregnant and go to America and all that. Anyway, so we did have that little girl, and when she was 3 years old, we should go back to Sweden and show her off, you know, and our families really wanted us back again. But by that time, we knew we wanted to stay in America. And alcoholism was not, or alcohol was not a part of our life. And those first 3 years, for one thing, we probably couldn't afford it. But we were so busy becoming Americans, you know, and getting used to California. Anyway, in those days, we flew to New York, and then you went by ship across to Sweden. And it was on that ship, John's relatives in New York said, "Now when you go across, instead of taking Dramamine, why don't you drink scotch?" they said. And when they said that, I said, "Oh, what a great idea. And I can't even answer you for that. I mean, it doesn't make any sense knowing what I did about heavy drinking, but that's what I said." And I tell you, we had a wonderful time on the ship. And we came, and I love that scotch. I still love scotch. But you know how it's come to be now. But anyway, we came to Sweden, and people were throwing parties for us over there, and we had a ball. And by the time we came back to California, Johnny had a job in an expense account. So now we really set out to have fun. And people took us out, and we took people out and entertained them, and we went to parties, and we had parties, and we had so much fun that in no time at all we had 4 children. And by this time we had moved down to Corona del Mar, a little town very close to where we live now. And I'd be on the beach during the week, and then on the weekends we'd party. And I have a babysitter come in for the kids, and off we go. And that's how we live now. But after a few years of that, I began to have second thoughts about this whole thing. And I had a talk with John, the first of many. And I told him that this drinking life was not good. It's not good for us and not for the children. And we were going to give it up. And Johnny just asked me to run along. He wasn't interested in that plan at all. So we still went out and we still had parties, but now I couldn't enjoy myself anymore. Now I had to watch what he was doing. And I took my job seriously. So you can imagine how that went. The arguments and the fights. We moved to Anaheim at that time, and this was in 1958. All the big building stuff was going on in Southern California, and we moved into a tract of homes. We were all young people coming in there with our little kids, and these people were church people and civic-minded and did serious things, and they were not really heavy drinkers, but we tried to blend in, especially John. He's very gregarious and loves to talk to people and tell stories and all that. I remember on Friday nights they started having potlucks, you know, and you'd meet at someone's house and bring a dish of food and a bottle, and so we did that too, and of course, Johnny wouldn't let go of his bottle. He put it under his chair, you know. Everybody put everything in the kitchen, you know. And then he'd misbehave, you know, at the party, and I'd have to straighten him out on the way home. And then Saturday morning, he'd come out and say, "Hey, didn't we have a good time?" I wouldn't talk to him. I just turned my head and... So he'd get his gear together, and everybody was putting in lawns and flowers and everything. Everything was bare, you know. And so he'd get his tools and his stuff and his bottle and his cups. And he'd set up shop out on the front lawn, you know, and he had a big gate post. And then he'd wave people over to come over and have a drink. See, he had his bar out there. And some of the guys would sort of look around to see where their wives were, and they'd come over, but they couldn't stay. They had work to do, too. The last people who gave up on him were the watchtower people. They came around, you know, in a new tract of homes, and they'd be out there, and John would have his arm around the guy's shoulder, you know, and they didn't drink with him, but they discussed the end of the world, I know that. And it got so I dreaded the weekends, you know. It was all right when he went off to work, but the weekends were a pain to me because I had grown up in little towns up there in Sweden, and where I hated to see my father. He didn't drive a car. Hardly anybody drove a car up there. And I'd see him walking around the lawn weaving, you know, and he had a big black overcoat that flapped around him and a big black hat. And I just hated to be known that he was my father. And I was always embarrassed. And now I was embarrassed in Anaheim, you know, by this guy. And I was always trying to improve myself. At the time I was reading Sinclair Lewis, and learning to read English, of course. And there was a story in there about a family who had a drunk in their family. And they hid him in the attic. You know, they locked him up in the attic. Put food outside, you know, so he could. And I thought, that's what I'd like to do with John. You know, I'd like to hide him. I wanted to hide him. Of course, I let him out to go to work, but I mean. Well, I got sick very soon. I think what happened to me, I had counted so much on being out of that kind of life by marrying John. And here's what's happening to me again. I wasn't going to have to stand by the window and wait like my mother did and be stood up on appointments and all those things. My life was going to be different, but it wasn't. It was the same thing. And once in a while, I'd pick on one of my neighbors, and I'd tell her parts of it, you know. And then I'd go home, and then I'd start feeling disloyal. And then I'd start thinking, now she knows about us. And then I'd resent her, and I wouldn't see her again. And I cut myself off after one after the other of my neighbors. And I got so I couldn't even go to the market. I tell you, the only way I could get any work done was if I was angry. If I was angry, I could work and clear up the house and take care of things. But if I really let myself feel and realize how sad our life had become, I couldn't move. And I think even John could see that I was in trouble. I'd go to the market too, and I'd put stuff in my basket. And if anyone spoke to me, I'd leave everything and walk back home again. I could not face people. And so we had one more of our talks. We regularly, like John said, had talks and started over again. But this time John said, you know, it isn't worth it to me if the drinking is going to do this to you. And he said, I'm going to give it up. Because Johnny had been in on a few episodes with my dad before we left for America. But Johnny said, no, I'm going to give it up. He said, I tell you what, in 3 weeks' time, I'll have these jobs finished, and we'll take a little trip, we'll take the kids, and we'll go to Palm Springs, and we'll have a vacation. And, you know, those 3 weeks were wonderful. The children began to relax around him, and he and I were friends again, and we were going to be all right. On the morning when we should leave for Palm Springs, when I got up, Johnny was drunk. He'd started to drink during the night. And it just took me. I just floored me. And I thought, he shouldn't go. He shouldn't drive. But then we went anyhow, and it was a disaster. He drove much too fast, and we came to Palm Springs, and he used to take us out to lunch, and fell in the restaurant, and it was bad. I tried to take my life that weekend. You see, I had figured it out. There had been a love before me, and I was sure that Johnny was sad that he hadn't married that other girl, and that's why he had the drink. I never talked to him about this. I just figured it out. And also, I knew I wasn't giving everything to the children. I barely had time for them because I had to worry about where he was and who he was with and all that. So, and I had, when we were home in Sweden, I'd said some really hurtful things to my father. And I thought everybody would be better off without me. Well, I got very sick and eventually got back to Anaheim. And it was soon after that our minister came to call on us. And I sure wasn't going to tell him how we lived. But he was so kind and thoughtful that I began to tell him about my father's drinking. And then pretty soon I was telling him about John's drinking. And he suggested I come to him once a week for an hour and talk. He said that would surely help. And if you can get John to come, he can have another hour on another day. And I thought, oh, he won't do that. He's so selfish. But I told John the next day about what the minister had said, and Johnny said, of course I'll go. How kind of him. And that surprised me. Well, now we were both getting help. We had each an hour there. And it did help. He didn't fight so much anymore. It took some of the pressure off. But it was over a year later when I came to the minister one morning that he said to me, "Yes," he said, "I do think John is an alcoholic." And now I had thought of John as an alcoholic for several years already. It was no secret to me that it was the drinking that had changed him. But the minister said to me, "If he is an alcoholic, he has three ways to go. He will either go crazy from it, or he will die from it, or he can get help." Well, I never even heard the last part. You know, it didn't register. And I can still remember how I felt that morning when I walked home from his study. I was finally, it was clear to me, I wasn't going to be able to fix John. Nothing I said or did helped. But I even understood that the minister couldn't do it. I had thought it would, you see. But here, it was all this time later, and Johnny was still drinking. But you know, I think I even understood that Johnny couldn't fix it. Because in that year, I had seen him try to stop drinking several times, and he got back to it. And I think something happened to me that morning. I didn't understand it then, but I understand it now, because I have seen it happen to people who come into Al-Anon with somebody still out there. And it was just sort of removed from me, and that was not my doing. I just sort of gave up on the whole thing. And I was called back to Sweden at that time. My father was ill, and tickets were sent for me and my little boy. He was the youngest. And I left, and left the girls with John, and the minister said, "We'll find a woman to look after them." And I went back to Sweden. But while I was there, I started to think, I have to learn to go to work, because I knew I couldn't live with the drinking much longer. I had such violent feelings of anger and about the unfairness of it, and, you know. And I knew I would have to learn to go to work again, because I would probably be alone. And I came back to Los Angeles. It was a gray, overcast day at LAX, and Johnny was there in gray slacks and a gray shirt and a gray face, and he was shaking, and I was right back into it again. But I did get a little half-day job. This is going to pick up a little. This is, you know. And I worked for a, it was a half-day, and I worked for an insurance agent in Fullerton, a little town next to Anaheim. And he was very successful, and he was being groomed for politics, and he was president of this and that civic organization, and he was a tall, slender man, and he'd come flying into his office every morning in his three-piece suit, you know, and he looked so spiffy. And Johnny used to look like that too, you know, but he didn't anymore. And I'm not above doing a little knifing when I think I have some ammunition, so I'd hold up this fellow to John that he could be like him, you know, then he might have something. But Johnny's been that man's sponsor for the last 22 years. Central office called him to make a call at one of the honor farms, and there he was. And John said, "There is some justice after all." And John used to drive me to work in the morning after the kids went on the bus. And then we tried to say a few civil words to each other, you know, nothing serious. And then by the time he picked me up in the afternoon, he came straight from the bar and he was drunk. We'd stop at the liquor store on the way home, and it was in the parking lot there one afternoon. Johnny said to me, "You see that guy over there with the brown paper bag?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "He's an alcoholic." I said, "How do you know that?" "Every day when I'm here, he's here." Well, I said we weren't fighting much anymore, and we weren't. Not very much was going on at our house. And but we had one more Donnybrook. Carolyn, our oldest girl, was 13, and it was time for an open house at school. And Johnny always insisted on attending the children's function, you know, because he thought he probably couldn't be as bad as I said he was if he did. And, of course, it was a pain to have along, you know. Have you taken a drunk to PTA lately? I mean, forget it. And he'd be weaving, you know, and you could smell him, the whiskey, you know, all across the room. And I was always afraid he was going to put his hand on one of the teachers, you know, and tell some story or something. Here it was, and Johnny said, well, it's time to go to open house. And I said, oh, John, you look so tired. Why don't you stay home? And, of course, then he had to go over, and he knew I didn't want him to go, so. But then Carolyn spoke up. And our children had not participated in our quarrels at all. They never said anything to their dad. But Carolyn spoke up and said, Dad, I don't want you to come to my school. You're a drunk and you always embarrass me. And Johnny slapped her across the face. And I tell you, it broke it up. I mean, that had never happened before. And I know what it did to me. It brought me right back to that time when I could never keep my mouth shut with my dad. And I thought about this thing for a few days. And I thought, this is it. This is my first teenager. And I have three more coming along. And I decided to have one more talk with John. And I said, you know, I'm not going to accept that the children are going to be slapped around. And either you have to go down and try the Alcoholics Anonymous or you have to go away. And I didn't know anything about Al-Anon. I certainly didn't know anything about don't make threats you don't intend to carry out. It seemed to me we just went on. But then one night, Johnny came home, and he said to me, let's go and talk in the living room. And he said, you know, I'm not drinking anymore. I said, you're not? No, he said, I have been going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't think I have to drink again. And, you know, I didn't know what to say. Johnny tells that I said, your eyes look different, and that's certainly God's grace, because I knew what I thought. And he said he wasn't drinking anymore, not even in the garage. You know, my main thing in life was that he should never be able to put anything over on me, you know. Well, here it was. Now we had sobriety in our house. And every afternoon when Johnny came to my office to pick me up, he was sober. And we never stopped anywhere. We went home. And it was wonderful. But he was full of stories about the Alana Club in Anaheim. And then he began to talk about Charlie. And guess what his Charlie told me today? And this is what Charlie says, you see. And Charlie says this. And I said, well, for heaven's sake, bring him home. I wanted to meet him. I wanted to see what he had that I didn't have. I had said some of those things too, you know. And so one night after the meeting, here they came, and here was Charlie, and he was a tall, nice-looking man, and he was sober. I could see that. And I had to tell this, I could go jump free. Fast forward a moment. I thought that now it was really going to get tough on John. You know, there were going to be the, now he had a sponsor that sounded, you know, responsible to me. And this man was going to really teach him about a few things that I already knew. But, and I thought maybe there would be some written tests or something. That's how my mind works. And when Charlie died 2 years ago, he was John's sponsor all that time. And John got another sponsor. And he went to talk to him. And when he came home, I said, well, John, what did John Haley say? He's the sponsor. And Johnny said, there's going to be some written tests. Anyway, every day after dinner, and sometimes she had dinner with us, Charlie would show up to take Johnny to a meeting. And this went on for about a month, I think. I stayed on that pink cloud. But then I started thinking, it's still his show. I'm still stuck here at home with the kids, you know. And I asked John, you know, is it really necessary to go to a meeting every night? He said, I'll check. Yeah, it was. It was necessary. And of course, you know, that time of day, right after dinner in the household with a bunch of kids, it's nobody's turn to do the dishes. Nobody can find their homework. There's no shampoo. She wore my sweater today. We even remember little John, who was 6 years old. He was a baby. And Carolyn said, well, little John should do dishes too, you know, just because he's a boy, doesn't he? So she said, get out there, little John, and start doing the dishes. And little John said, I've got cramps. Anyway, so after I had complained about being left alone at home all the time, you know, they began to invite me to come to open meetings, to speaker meetings at the Alarma Club. And I have to tell you, that Alarma Club, I've seen a lot of Alarma Clubs over the years, but that one, I haven't matched it yet. It was really downtown in a district I'd never been in. And there wasn't a chair in the place but 35 old sofas with sleazy bedspreads on them. I can't even describe the smoke. Some of you old-timers know what the smoke was like. And of course, as the years went by, the sloshier John got, the more proper I got, you know. So here comes Miss Pris into this place. And you know, it was given to me, and it surely was a gift. I just loved that place. I had never any trouble coming in there. I just felt so safe and so full of hope in there. And I could see that these people had been heavy drinkers, and I could see they were sober, and I was so impressed with that. And that's where I got to hear all the great AA speakers. You have them on tapes out there, Norm Alpie and Chuck C. And Clancy came, he was 4 years sober then, and Alan McGinnis. And there was a beautiful AA lady, Marion Forbes was her name. She was beautiful to look at and beautifully dressed. She came sweeping in there on Sunday morning in a white cashmere coat, you know, and I, of course, right away, where can you put that coat, you know? Not on those sofas, surely, but she kept it on. I was down for that. And Johnny bought the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous right away, and I read it right away, because I knew I could better help him with his program. And I loved it, you know, I still love the big book. And I thought, oh, it's so plainly written. It's like an arrow into your heart, you know. And I was so, I thought it was so wonderful. And here was John, you know. By that time, Johnny asked me to quit my job and be home again. And I was glad to do that. I wanted to be there when the kids got home. And Johnny's always been fortunate to have part of his office at home, so he was there a lot. And Charlie didn't seem to have anywhere to go either, so he was there a lot. But I didn't care. They were going to work this beautiful spiritual program, you see. And except I could never hear them talk about it. It seemed to me they told a lot of funny stories and they laughed a lot. And they discussed Charlie's automobile. He had an old Austin Healey. But then I figured it out. Charlie hadn't told Charlie what he had put me through. You see, Charlie didn't know. So I'll tell you what I did. On Sunday morning, I got in the car and I drove over to Charlie and Virginia's house and I told them everything. Everything, Palm Springs, the whole thing. And they didn't say very much. I remember they looked at their shoes a lot. It was soon after that that Charlie began to talk about some women he knew that met in the back room of that club. And that's how I came to Al-Anon. And they certainly told me that we work the same 12 steps that the alcoholics do. And they said we don't talk about the alcoholic in the meeting. I had a little trouble with that. But so now I was in Al-Anon. And I must say, I've heard you AAs talk about how difficult it is to come in and start working these 12 steps after you've hit bottom. But you ought to try it coming in perfect. It is hard. What do you want to do when there's nothing wrong with you? You have nothing to work with. But I tried. And I even got a sponsor. And I tell you, I was really fine in the meetings. Except it never lasted all the way home, you know. I had a lot of trouble letting go of the past. And I can still remember, I began to hear things in the meetings, you know. And I could feel kind of a shift within me. And but I was afraid to try some of those things because I didn't want it to benefit him, you know. I was so worried that he might feel good if I did something different. Because I had sort of hoped, and I didn't like what was going on in the AA meetings, really. All that laughter, for one thing. And I had sort of thought that they would teach him a few things in there and point out a few things, you know. Maybe rough him up a little bit. But none of that. They carried on, you know. We'd come into that big AA room, and there they would be. Hello. Oh, John, you look wonderful. How long do you have now? Oh, hi, Karen. Oh. And we have something in Al-Anon called the do's and the don'ts. I don't know. Do you read them up here, too? Maybe not. You have we have 9 do's and 10 don'ts. I'm not going to read them all, but a couple of the do's are learn the facts about alcoholism and they go to Al-Anon meetings often. And then the don'ts, some of them are don't try to dominate, scold, nag and complain. Don't lose your temper. Don't keep bringing up the past. Don't keep checking up on the alcoholic. And I thought, great, isn't this going to make it cushy for the alcoholic, you know? And you know, it took me a couple of years to figure out that if I could stop doing those things, I would be free, you see. But I couldn't see that then. And I used to call my sponsor, Myrna was her name. And I said, now, you want to hear this, Myrna, what he said to me last night? And Myrna said, have you made the bed? Made the bed. Well, I went and made the bed, and then I called her again. I said, are you ready for this? You want to hear what he said to me? And she said, have you done the dishes? And I'm so grateful that she kept me on the ground because I had visions of myself becoming spiritual like that beautiful AA lady, you know, and really sailing up. But that wasn't going to happen. Everything had to be right down to earth for me. And I had one thing that I thought had worked somewhat for me during the drinking. And that was, I used to hold up to John how he was hurting the kids by never teaching them anything, never taking them anywhere. And I knew I could get to him with this because of his father dying when he was 8 years old. And I'd watch him play with them or teach them things and shake and sweat, you know. And I thought, oh, serves him right. And but now I was doing the same thing. Of course, now I couldn't hold off the drinking any longer. And I wanted to say, too, the bottom line for me was that I was so glad that he was sober. I don't take anything away from that. I was so glad that he was sober. But I hadn't counted on that he was going to be happy. It's just... me up, you know, and to have fun in here. I mean, really. So here it was. No, I was still doing this thing. You know, when you have a bunch of kids, they cry and fight. And then I said, yes, John, after all, you're an alcoholic. And all that drinking must have damaged them. And you know, Johnny wouldn't defend himself. He'd just say, yes, Ken, I'm so sorry, but I'm trying to do better. And you know, I did that over and over again. And each time I felt smaller and smaller inside. And I talked to Myrna about it. I said, Myrna, this is what I'm doing. And I somehow felt I was losing him, you know. It was as if I knew that if he couldn't live peaceably with me, he would leave, but he wouldn't get up, give up AA. And Myrna said to me, Karen, you're going to have to let go of the past. You have to forgive him. You can't keep just bringing this up again. Nobody can fix the past. You can't fix this. Johnny can't fix it. The only way you can get a better past is to have a better present. And she said, I think it's time for your inventory. It's time you take your fourth step. And she sort of stressed your fourth step. And I was always willing. I read the fourth step in our Alamon literature and in the big book, in the 12 and 12 AA book. And my whole reaction to the fourth step was, what did I ever do? I stayed home and took care of the kids. And I told that to Myrna, and that was my fifth step, you see. And there I was, you see. And I had just done this thing again, put that knife in, and I came to the meeting, and I felt so alone and so isolated from everyone. And I thought, I don't even have a right to be in Al-Anon. They think I'm doing so well, but I'm not the same way at home as I am in the meeting. And I was in such despair, you know. And something happened in that meeting for me. I was like, I was all alone. And something came back to me that had happened 5 years before sobriety. And we were in our second year on the program. John had to go to San Diego on a job, and he asked me to come along. And for some reason, we took Katrina with us. Katrina, our youngest girl, was 3 years old. And we drove to San Diego. Well, I had some things, some accusations to make to John that morning. I overheard a little, and I had to figure the rest of it out by myself. And I was really going to give it to him. And I tell you, I screamed and I swore and I cried in that car all the way to San Diego. I even tried to open the car door while Johnny was driving. And Johnny tried to calm me down, and little Katrina begged me to stop, and there was no stopping me. I was just insane with jealousy and rage. It was so clear to me. And we came to San Diego, and Johnny took care of his work. And we drove home, and I did the very same thing all the way home. I was absolutely crazy. And when we got back to the house, my mother was there with the other kids. And I hopped out of the car, and I said, hi, how is everybody? And, you know, I had never once, that was 7 years later, I had never once thought of those horrible hours. How scary it must have been for little Katrina. And how hopeless for John, where he was then, too. And then other things began to come back to me. That time when we should go to Palm Springs and Johnny had started to drink. And I thought he shouldn't drive. But then a cool thought in the back of my head said, oh yes, we go. And if something happens on the road, maybe that'll scare him. You know, now I was the children's champion. I was the sane and sober one. But that's what I did. And another time, I had taken my two girls shopping on a Saturday morning, and we left the baby at home, and we went shopping, and we had lunch, and in the car going home, I thought, oh my God, I hope the baby is all right. And then I thought, well, if he isn't, and we got home, And Johnny was passed out in the long swing, and the baby was sitting on the steps of the pool playing. I was in my glory that afternoon. I blamed that whole thing on John. And you know, by that time, John was a daily drinker. He was a morning drinker. And on Saturday especially, he woke up early and started drinking and passed out and woke up in the afternoon. And I knew that. So there I was. And some of the things from home. And I finally understood I couldn't pass myself off as a victim any longer. This was my stuff. And Mona had said to me, you have to forgive John. Well, I knew John was forgiven. Whoever should forgive him had forgiven him, because he was changing. He was a new man. But now I needed forgiveness myself. And that's what has to happen, I think. We have to finally see our own part in it. And then I told this to Myrna, and at that time I had just met Elsa Chamberlain, and I told it to her. And she said, well, now you have to let go of that. Now you are at the sixth step. That's where you can begin to ask God to help you to change. And of course, this happened a long time ago. And we have such a peaceful life. And we have been given so much during these 36 years. And all the children are grown, of course. Three of them, the three girls are married. And the boy is getting married in September, thank goodness. I told John I want him to get married while he still can be trained, you know. He didn't even smile. I'm just going to tell one thing, and then I'm going to sit down, I promise. I talk about how powerful the Al-Anon program is, because it's, you know, it's kind of hard to see that you even need to change when nothing is very obvious, you know. It's obvious to other people, but not to you. I mean, you don't get in tickets. You don't get picked up for weaving and stuff like that. And this happened to me in my first year on Al-Anon. One of my Al-Anon friends had to go to work, and she said, I want you to make this 12-step call. And I said, okay. And I went in, to this house, and I knocked on the door, and this woman opened the door a little bit, and I said, I'm here from Al-Anon, and she let me in. All the drapes were drawn in the house, and she spoke to me in whispers, and she was married to this very successful commercial builder. He was gone for the weekend. That's how come she had dared to call Al-Anon. But she was so fearful. And you know, nothing had happened to me yet. There had been no change within me. But I had sense enough to ask her if she wanted to go to an Al-Anon meeting. And we went that night. And she heard and felt something in that meeting. And we began to go to Al-Anon meetings together. And of course, he had come back again. And he'd be out on that porch glaring at me every time I came to pick her up. And but we went. And I remember she enrolled in a business class at the night school, and she had a long green Buick automobile that she hadn't driven for several years. She was so fearful, and she had that shot stopped and started to drive again. And of course, I had already learned in AA meetings that you can't promote this thing, you know, you can't sell it. But I threw that rule out, and I made John go and make a 12-step call on this guy. And he told John, if you ever show your face here again, I'll kill you. So that didn't work. So one night when I came to pick her up, this guy had really had it. He was true. He stood out there on the porch and he said, if you get in that car with that silly woman one more time, you needn't come back. I'll change all the locks. I'll close all the accounts. You'll be begging in the streets, and on and on. He was foaming at the mouth. He was so mad. And I sat in my car, and I thought, yeah, go back in with him. You know, this was a dumb idea from the beginning. And but she just stood there, and he went on raving. And then when he drew his breath a moment, she said, I'm sorry, but I have to go to my meeting. And she marched right past him, and we drove off. Well, something had changed. Now he could see that she wasn't afraid of him. And so he said, okay, I'll tell you what, I'll go to one of those stupid meetings, and then I don't want to hear this nonsense anymore, you know. So we said, thank you. And it was October, and it was time for a Southern California convention, and it was held in Anaheim at the convention center. And on Sunday morning, John and I took them there. And we stood in that lobby. It's just like out here, you know. And on Sunday morning, you know, everybody's 2 feet off the floor from all the love and gratitude and buzzing. And he stood there like he was made out of ice, but he didn't run. And we came into the meeting. And Chuck Steve was speaking that morning. If you haven't heard him, get a tape. And 10 minutes into Chuck's talk, we saw it happen to this guy. Oh. It was as if something fell off of him. Something I can't explain. And he reached over and took his wife's hand. Took his wife's hand, you know. I mean, you wouldn't have thought that in a million years. And that was the beginning for him, of course. And he died a few years ago. And he had 18 years of sobriety. Well, quite a few years ago. He had 18 years of sobriety. And those two people were helped so many people, you know. And this is what we get to be around, you know. And, of course, his wife had found her inner strength in those Al-Anon meetings and backed off, you know, stopped begging him, stopped bringing up the drinking, went to see about doing something for herself. And that's what we want you to do, to get your own life. It doesn't mean that you have to throw the drunk away, God forbid, but I mean, they're hard to throw away too. But you know, not to hover over them anymore. And it changed the climate in their house enough that he could see his way. I tell you, I am so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous and to Al-Anon and to all of you. Thank you.